This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Uhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
You can hear the gunshots around, little bombings around. We're all scared. Everyone, not me alone. Because, you know, no one wants war. Many have no money to drink water alone. Talk less of the food to eat.
That was Nigerian student Abdulaziz Jikan Liman, who is stuck in a school hostel in Sudan. Details coming up. Also, U.S. entrepreneur Elon Musk is struggling to launch his satellite internet service in Africa. And South Africa's Supreme Court of Appeal upholds a ruling against public display of the old apartheid-era flag. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Dozens of countries scrambled to arrange transportation to get their citizens out of Sudan amid concerns that fighting could escalate and cut off exits from the country. The death toll has surpassed 400, with nearly 4,000 people reported injured. And today, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said the situation is worsening and could engulf the entire region.
We'll continue our efforts with our partners to secure a permanent halt to the fighting as soon as possible. Working with humanitarian organizations on the ground, we are reconfiguring our presence in Sudan to enable us to continue supporting the Sudanese people. Let me be clear, the United Nations is not leaving Sudan. Our commitment is to the Sudanese people in support of their wishes for a peaceful and secure future. We stand with them at this terrible time. I've authorized the temporary relocation both inside and outside Sudan of some United Nations personnel and of families. I call on all council members to exert maximum leverage with the parties to end the violence, restore order, and return to the path of the democratic transition.
In a news conference today in Washington, Kenya's Secretary for Foreign and Diaspora Affairs, Dr. Alfred Mutua, said neighboring states are working to open talks with the two warring sides.
As members of IGAD, we have decided to be at the forefront in finding a solution to all these problems. We do believe that we are at a good place because the two warring leaders are talking to us. So that's a good sign. You know, when they're being talked to, they're talking back, and we're able to open the channels of communication. The fighting is still going on in Sudan, but we just feel that at least we have an entryway. They have not locked themselves up and shut their ears to the world. They're listening to the world, and they know the pressure that is being felt around them. Our president is ready. We have said that Kenya is ready at any moment's notice. Even if our president may not be able to go there immediately, we are ready to start discussions. And that's a message we are communicating to them, is that send us part of your teams. Let's start talking about what needs to be achieved, because there's a reason they are fighting. They are fighting because they can't agree about something. And we need to be able to sort out what they can't agree about, find a common agreeable ground.
Mutua is in Washington for meetings at the U.S. State Department with Secretary of State Antony Blinken. Residents in Khartoum and many other cities are hunkered down with rapidly shrinking food and water supplies, worsened by power and communication outages. Muwada Ali is an Eritrean who had been a student in Khartoum. She decided to evacuate to Kassala, closer to the border with Eritrea.
The way was the journey was very long, 12 hours, more than it takes, because they changed the road. They took us from another road. When we get on the small bus, the driver told us to hide our phones and the money, because there might be some robbers, and the rapid forces also, they might stop us for search in search points. And this last 5 days I was so scared. It was the hardest days in my life. But now I feel safe. Now I'm safe and sound in Kassala. We don't hear gun shooting anymore. I only hear rooster and goats and birds.
The exodus of foreigners included a nighttime pullout of U.S. diplomats and other personnel Saturday, a week after the fighting erupted. The U.S. also closed its embassy in Khartoum. Other countries with the resources to act on their own quickly followed suit. Many European nations and the European Union have evacuated hundreds of staff. Other nations pleaded with the two factions to create a safe corridor for those who are increasingly desperate to leave the country. Aid agencies also are seeking to get supplies and medical assistance to the needy. The prospects of an airlift have been complicated by the closure of Khartoum's main airport. You will find frequent updates on the Sudan crisis on voaafrica.com and in our news programmings. The U.S. and the United Kingdom have evacuated embassy personnel from Sudan. Other countries are trying to get their citizens out of the capital, Khartoum, today as fighting continues between competing military factions for a 10th day. The wider implications for sustained fighting between the Rapid Support Forces paramilitary group and the army include a large number of refugees heading to neighboring countries, something they are not prepared to handle, according to Rebecca Hamilton, a professor of law at American University and a former Washington Post correspondent who has written extensively about the country. Hamilton tells VOA's Carol Van Damme, "Everyone outside Sudan loves the story of overthrowing a dictatorship, but the story does not end there, and many in the diplomatic community failed to recognize that after the democratic revolution in 2019.
When you have a history of 30 years of dictatorship that you're having to overcome, the people that benefited from that dictatorship, they don't just disappear overnight. But you also can't get them all out of the country. So you have to figure out a way to deal with them. So there is always going to be this really messy transition period. And the challenge is to keep as much attention on the country and as much resources and investment in the country in that transition period as you had at that sort of moment of celebration and victory. And I think that's where we fell down. So it was never going to be the case that you could move from Omar al-Bashir in charge to having full civilian rule overnight.
Because they had the weapons?
Because they had the weapons, right? You can't sort of change that fact. You would love to just sort of magic wand it away, and that's not the reality that you're dealing with. But that then means you have to be very careful about managing that transition. And certainly when Burhan and Hamedi really showed their true colors with the 2021 that ousted the civilian parts of that transitional government, that was the time to say, you've shown your colors and you can't be part of this going forward.
So we're here now, and this bloody battle's been going on for a while. What are the wider implications for the region as it drags on?
So first of all, Sudan is huge. Even with the loss of South Sudan, it is an enormous country. It's bordering seven other countries. So just for starters, refugee flows are going to impact all of the surrounding states. I think the UN is estimating some 20,000 refugees have already crossed the border into Chad from Darfur. We're seeing the efforts to get out to Egypt. We're going to see this in terms of refugee flows into South Sudan. And none of these countries have the ability to absorb the numbers of Sudanese refugees that are coming. So we have an immediate humanitarian crisis and destabilization of the entire region. And then the other questions are going to be, what are these other regional actors, the UAE, the Saudis and Egypt, are they going to do the responsible thing and say to whichever side they're backing, you cannot win this through a military battle?
Is it up to them now? Is it up to the regional actors to step up?
So it's up to everybody, but I think they are key because they are going to be the source of the weaponry that will be needed to continue this battle. And they can cut off that flow of resources to each side, and they really need to do that.
That's Rebecca Hamilton, professor of law at American University. She was speaking with VOA's Carol Van Damme in Washington. Nigerian authorities say they are trying to evacuate 5,000 Nigerians, especially students, who are stranded in Sudan due to fighting there. The Nigerian Labour Congress and student unions have criticized the government for failing to evacuate them sooner. Nigeria's foreign ministry said Sudan's government has yet to give them approval for the evacuations. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja, Nigeria.
The National Emergency Management Agency, or NEMA, on Monday said authorities have concluded plans to begin evacuating the first group of 3,500 Nigerian students in Sudan beginning Tuesday morning. The director of special duties at NEMA, Onimode Bandele, told VOA via phone that the students will be taken by bus to Cairo and then flown to Nigeria. Bandele did not say when the remaining nationals will be evacuated.
This is a country that's in turmoil. You don't just go in there and want to bring people out for security reasons. In an attempt to evacuate, you should be mindful of the fact that we don't want to lose any life to you. But now that there's a window, the government is exploring that window to get these people back to safety.
A power tussle between Sudan's military and strong paramilitary group, the Rapid Support Forces, started a fight on April 15th in the capital of Khartoum. Officials say more than 400 people have been killed and thousands more wounded. Many Sudanese and foreigners are fleeing the fighting, but millions of others have taken refuge in their homes and schools. Nigerian student Abdulaziz Jikan Liman, who is stuck in a school hostel, says he and those around him live in perpetual fear.
You can hear the gunshots around, little bombings around. We're all scared, everyone, not me alone, because, you know, no one wants war. Many have no money to drink water alone, talk less of the food to eat.
Nigerian authorities on Sunday said it would be too dangerous to evacuate citizens without security clearances. But union groups such as the Nigerian Labour Congress and the National Association of Nigerian Students, NANSE, have criticized authorities for not acting sooner. Babatunde Akintaye is the vice president of NANSE.
They are taking too long. If not for our cries, if not for the way we started raising eyebrow and started talking about it, our government might not even do anything. Now they say they want to start the evacuation tomorrow. As we speak to you, there is no official statement to the student community that this is where to meet. This is how they should be prepared.
Both factions have ignored ceasefires in the past, including a three-day halt last Friday to mark the Eid al-Fitr holiday, which ends the Muslim holy month of Ramadan. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
As countries rush to evacuate their diplomats and citizens from Khartoum, Sudanese nationals are fending for themselves amid power blackouts and loss of internet service. Sama Salaman is a Sudanese strategic analyst and president of the U.S. Educated Sudanese Association. She tells VOA's Douglas Mpuga that as fighting between two rival factions continues, some Sudanese have decided to take the dangerous roads in cars and buses to escape.
As of this morning, from my relatives and friends and sources in Khartoum, what we're hearing is that airstrikes are becoming more aggressive. And they're now hitting homes, residences, hospitals, schools outside the center of Khartoum. So whereas many of our friends and relatives had actually moved from their homes in the downtown center of Khartoum to areas 10, 15 miles outside to areas like Omdurman, for example, even those areas are now being shelled. So no one is actually safe anymore. So those families are now seriously considering crossing the border into Egypt, along with the thousands who have been crossing on a daily basis over the past couple of days, as well as crossing the border into Ethiopia or Chad. So it's a very tragic and horrific situation.
From what you're hearing, how easy is it to cross the borders?
So far, the crossing into Egypt has been the most reliable and accessible way of crossing out of Sudan. So it's not difficult. It's a very long journey. There are lots of checkpoints. There's also the threat of being attacked by either side on the way there. There are several stops. So the journey is actually almost twice as long as it normally would be because of the fact that they have to reroute and move away from areas of potential airstrikes and also away from the military bases as well as away from the RSF bases.
There have been ceasefires declared and none of them has held. How do you see this situation ending up or improving?
Unfortunately, none of the ceasefires have held. None of the pleas to open up humanitarian corridors had been heeded. And that's even more worrying because the fact that the two sides are so aggressive and so charged means that this is becoming a battle of egos. I mean, the fact that they are not even heeding responses to children who are injured and need medication, people who are actually forecast to become hungry over the next 2 to 3 days. So we're seeing a serious possible shortage of food and a hunger crisis that could emerge and unfold in the next 2 to 3 days. And I think that, you know, from speaking to some of the humanitarian organizations, the only possible way that they could access could be food airdrops.
Given that this is a complicated conflict, what do you say to those who say maybe other countries may be meddling into the situation, making it worse?
Well, I think that certainly there are reports that General Haftar in Libya is supporting Hemeti with arms, and I think this is definitely making it worse. It's exacerbating the situation. We know that Russia's Wagner Group has for a long time supported Hemeti and the RSF with weapons and military training, and what this has done is actually create a proxy battle between the U.S. and Russia in Sudan, and this is really serious as both, you know, the U.S. and Russia fight for hegemony in Africa. We see the Gulf states such as Saudi Arabia and the UAE support Hemeti. We see Egypt with a long-standing, very strong relationship with General Burhan and Sudanese armed forces supporting al-Burhan. And so what you have right now is a situation where the regional support of the two actors is actually making the conflict even more violent because it's creating a very large flow of arms into Sudan. And the risk of this is not only this flow of arms into Sudan, but the spillover of these arms into neighboring countries that are also very fragile. For example, South Sudan with its own militias, Chad with its own militias. Chad has actually closed its borders for fear of the spillover of these weapons and movement of militia fighters between through the borders, very porous borders between Sudan and Chad. Ethiopia also has its own war and its own conflict and risks the spillover of weapons into Ethiopia. So you have a very, very, very complicated situation with many, many, many actors. And this makes the Sudan conflict, the Sudan civil war, not only a national conflict, but a regional conflict, and also a staging ground for international actors and their own proxy wars in Sudan.
That was Sama Salaman, a Sudanese strategic analyst and president of the U.S. Educated Sudanese Association. She spoke with Douglas Mpuga from the U.S. city of Boston. You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. American entrepreneur Elon Musk is struggling to launch his satellite internet service, Starlink, in Africa, with only 2 of 54 countries so far signing up to it. Musk's ISP has been operating around the world since 2020 on the back of his promise to make the internet cheaper and more reliable, the same promise regularly made by African governments. Darren Taylor reports.
Starlink uses satellites that orbit the Earth at a relatively low height to provide internet connectivity that Musk claims is the fastest and cheapest available. Arthur Goldstuck, founder of South Africa's Worldwide Works tech group, says Starlink has undoubtedly revolutionized internet usage globally.
The most dramatic example is Ukraine, where it's allowed internet access to continue uninterrupted, partly because Musk himself shipped a large volume of receivers to Ukraine. But having said that, he then expected the U.S. government to pay him for those. So he doesn't do anything without some kind of return for himself.
He says Starlink's data packages are indeed very attractive. The company sells monthly subscriptions for $110. That's not cheap enough to suddenly give millions of poor people the internet. But, says Goldstuck, it does allow users to download a huge 1,000 gigs of data. That would mean 1 gig costing less than 50 American cents. According to a recent study by Business Insider magazine, the average price per gig in sub-Saharan Africa in 2022 was almost $4.5 US. But Goldstuck says Nigeria and Rwanda are so far the only African countries making extensive use of Starlink's services.
And most of Africa expects access this year or next year. One of a few exceptions is South Africa, where the service date is unknown at this time. And that's because they can't get approvals to provide the service in South Africa. If you are able to import the receiver and the equipment, you can actually get it here, but it's going to be fairly costly.
In early March, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa appointed high-level African National Congress official Mondli Gungubele as Minister of Technology to lead South Africa's digital transformation. But the minister says he's not familiar with the Starlink issue.
That is not the item on my table at the moment. It's an item that I read. I see it in the newspapers. And I'll be very careful as a new minister to make comments with regard to that.
But Gungubele did reply in relative detail to opposition party the Democratic Alliance when it wrote to him asking why Starlink wasn't operating in South Africa. He responded that local branches of multinational companies, such as Musk's, must, by law, be 30% owned by persons from historically disadvantaged groups, and that Starlink hadn't agreed to this. Black economic empowerment stakes like this are often given to ruling party officials or people close to it. Goldstuck says in this context, it's unsurprising that Musk would refuse to effectively surrender almost a third of future South African profits to persons unknown.
There are other requirements as well that you see across Africa, like Tanzania, for example, is very close to giving approval, but they're requiring that Starlink actually set up an office in Tanzania. So various countries are looking at bureaucratic ways to stop additional competition from coming in, to prevent universal access. The government talks the language of universal access, but doesn't actually give effect to universal access.
He says governing elites in Africa actually want internet access to continue to be expensive, so they benefit from more taxes and their links to the profits of the continent's big mobile firms. Until this changes, says Goldstuck, millions of Africans won't have a path to arguably the most essential tool for progress in the modern world. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Nfunganyi, and our engineer, Charleston Monk, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.